Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
So welcome, everybody, to our EAN Cast weekly neurology on 4 weeks of neuroimaging. We are now in week two, and this regards the added value of PET scanning. And for today, I have two distinguished guests, and I would like to start with Dr. Nelike Tolboom. And she's a nuclear medicine physician at the University Medical Center in Utrecht, and has, a specific interest in the nuclear neuroimaging in some certain disorders, dementia, neuro-oncology, but also epilepsy. And, of course, has ample experience with amyloid imaging, and I guess we will come to this a little bit later. And our second speaker, I'm also glad to welcome Dr. Eduardo Spinelli. He's a neurologist and postdoc researcher at the Neuroimaging Research Unit of San Raffaele Scientific Institute in Milan, and has a very strong interest in structural and functional alterations of the CNS by advanced MRI techniques. But as you all, also a clinician at the Dementia Center in Milano, we will also include this experience to our chat. So welcome, both of you. My first question to you, Nelike, is, of course, because you're the nuclear physician on our board, what is the value of PET scanning? Is there a really true need, or is it more a kind of scientific approach, molecular approach to more in-depth looks to the brain, or is it also necessary for our routine practice?
Thank you, Professor Berger. Thank you for the kind introduction also. That's a very good question. I think most people think there is only value in research for nuclear medicine, but I think there's a very broad value also in the general clinic for neurology. So with the FDG PET, I'm not sure if all listeners are know a little bit about what the FDG PET is. That's the scanning we do with radioactive glucose. And I think the main workload we do is detection of oncology, staging of oncology, and detection of inflammation and infection in the whole body. And I think that is also an area that can help out the neurologist in his or her practice. For instance, if you have a patient with brain metastases or a lymphoma in the brain and you want to know if there are other locations, then an FDG PET can help you out to find the other areas in the body that might be affected. Besides from the body imaging, there are also dedicated neuro imaging aspects. I think the most well-known one is the FDG PET of the brain, for instance, in dementia imaging. And I think that is not a research tool, but that is really purely a clinical tool that can be used in clinic to aid the differential diagnosis in patients when it's difficult for the clinician or when the MRI isn't conclusive. So I think it's not just research, it's also very much a clinical tool.
Eduardo, you are a neurologist too, so where do you use PET scanning in a kind of routine practice in your hospital or in your routine work?
Thank you for this important question and for the nice introduction also. I work at the Dementia Center in Milan, as you said earlier, and I think that PET is actually useful nowadays in the clinical practice for the diagnosis of dementia, particularly in the prodromal stages. So when neuropathological changes are already present, but symptoms are still mild, and also for differentiate, for example, the most common type of dementia, which is Alzheimer's disease, from either frontotemporal lobar degeneration syndromes or other neurodegenerative, for example, Parkinsonian conditions, that in which diagnosis can be challenging due to the presence of overlapping syndromes. In fact, there's several lines of evidence actually supporting the use of PET together with other biomarkers to diagnose correctly these conditions and to identify not only the pattern of hypometabolism, so of neurodegeneration that is typical of each of these conditions, but also to suggest the possible underlying neuropathological alteration. In this case, of course, not only PET, but also, for example, CSF sampling gives some clues. But we have to think about the correct diagnostic algorithm and the intelligent use of all these techniques to come to a final diagnosis.
Thank you very much. I think the most important point you mentioned is this biomarker-based diagnosis of especially Alzheimer's, dementia, and or disease. And of course, I think even for the clinician, it's easy to diagnose dementia if it's already quite progressed. So the merit of the including the PET, specific PET scanning, is the early diagnosis. And Nelike, I guess you have a lot of experience with amyloid and tau PET scanning. Is this something which has already reached routine practice? And how good does this biomarker-driven PET imaging match the biomarker-driven CSF findings in Alzheimer's disease?
Good question. I think, well, if it has reached the clinic, it depends on the, I think, mainly the country and the certain hospital you work in. So for the Netherlands, where I work, the amyloid PET has definitely reached the clinic, where it started out in 2005 as a purely research tool. Now it's often used, especially like Dr. Spinelli just mentioned, in the differential diagnosis in the early patients. So it has reached the clinics. Of course, like you mentioned before, outside this talk, availability is an important question. So it has used the clinic, but it depends on the availability in the countries. How well it correlates with CSF, I think in Alzheimer's disease, it correlates very well with CSF. And obviously, if there is no amyloid PET available, then CSF is a very logical and very cost-effective choice. On that note, there's also, because Dr. Spinelli just mentioned that differential diagnostic dilemmas, there's also a very nice paper with a very nice graph illustrating which ligand or which test to use when in the European Journal of Molecular Imaging by Gaël Chetelet of 2021. So listeners could look that up. It's very practical. So it says if you have a patient that has a most probable diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, then you could turn, a first test you could turn to would be amyloid imaging or CSF, whichever you prefer, whichever is available in your hospital. And obviously, if the patient cannot undergo a lumbar puncture, then you could turn to PET.
So Eduardo, one question again to you. How is the situation in Italy, or probably from other countries, you know, in Europe? How easy is the access for the patient to PET imaging, apart from, you know, high-end institutions like San Raffaele or the University Center in Utrecht or also in Vienna? So is this something which is for a tertiary center, or is this already more easy accessible across the country, different levels of caregiving to patients?
Thanks for this question. There's actually a huge inhomogeneity, at least in Italy, and I think it's pretty much the same case across Europe, as there are several tertiary centers, maybe in the same city, for example, in Milan or Rome, or the biggest cities in Italy, as far as I know, whereas there are huge regions without any availability of PET scanner or with the access to the tracer that we can use for second level analysis. So it is much more performed, at least in the clinical practice, as far as I know, CSF sampling. But of course, as Dr. Tolbo mentioned, it is there, the use of amyloid PET is usually considered when people refuse lumbar puncture or in cases where CSF sampling is contraindicated due to the use of anticoagulants, or these are the cases in most cases. However, there's also, from a clinical point of view, I think the necessity to come to this second level analysis when CSF results are inconclusive, so we cannot actually make a final diagnosis based on CSF alone. But I'm afraid that up to now, this can be done only in some centers very specialized in dementia.
But nevertheless, I think, and I think this is something we all are aware, that there are some discrepancies also in various countries or even within countries, as you said. Nevertheless, because we were talking about dementia and Alzheimer's dementia, and if we now will have available treatments which are at the advent of being also approved or likely to be approved in Europe, then, of course, and they are definitely based on amyloid positivity, either in the CSF or on the PET scan, then, of course, it also creates the need to even, let's say, urge more facilities and more expertise centers, because you can't walk in a imaging private practice saying, I would like to have a PET scan right now. So I guess this also defines a kind of increase of the availability and therefore the accessibility. How do you see this development in the Netherlands, Nelleke?
I agree, Professor Berger. That definitely underlines the need for increased infrastructure. And I think in the Netherlands, I don't foresee a lot of problems, because we have a lot of PET centers also not only in the university teaching clinics, but also in the smaller hospitals, they have PET centers, and you can buy the amyloid imaging ligand as a PET center. But you need, as a nuclear medicine physician, you need to do the training that is provided by the companies that provide the ligand. So once you have done the training and then you can buy the ligand, then you can use it in your PET center. But for the interpretation of the amyloid scans, there obviously, besides the training that is provided, you need to have experience. So it would probably be wise to set up a network of colleagues that you can come in contact with. And this is for the more advanced cases. The reading of the amyloid scans are not terribly difficult, but in the earlier phases, it can be challenging. And then additional software could help out to help see the not the full-blown amyloid load, but the more subtle deposition.
Eduardo, do you agree with this view, or are you jealous about the PET scan density in the Netherlands?
No, I agree with what you said, and I think there is absolutely the need for that in the future. I wanted to add that something apart from the cost of the procedure itself and the availability of expertise in this area, another thing that we have to consider is the inhomogeneity across Europe about the reimbursement of this kind of technique. This is an economical question, but not so secondary, as some countries do have reimbursement, for example, for CSF procedures, but not for amyloid PET, or the amount of reimbursement is different. So this is very complicated, but we think that we need common European guidelines also regarding this point.
I would like, so we have a little bit talked about the current and the, let's say, immediate future, because that will happen in some way. So, Eduardo, you are also dedicated to more advanced MRI imaging. So what about hybrid techniques, overlaying MRI and PET scanning? Is there something where you see the future, and what kind of questions could be answered by this?
Thank you for this very interesting question, and very open to the future, because MRI is normally considered routine structural kind of analysis, but it actually can be developed and is now developed mostly in research, but I expect more and more in the clinics to be also a functional kind of analysis as resting state functional MRI or other kinds of functional MRI are increasingly being studied, and also novel procedures, techniques particularly to analyze these data are being developed by especially biomedical engineers. Most of the people listening to the podcast, this podcast may actually have heard of the connectome. So it is complicated, but not so far from being completely understood mathematical approach that can give some very important answers to how the brain functions. So from a point of view of how brain networks are organized and how they speak to each other. And this I'm aware that this kind of analysis can be applied both to MRI and to PET imaging. So a combined use of both techniques with similar approaches can actually give us some very important pathophysiological answers in order to understand these diseases, diagnose them earlier, and also to describe a prototypical pattern of disease spreading through brain networks, which is also a very important aspect to consider when we want to test novel drugs that can alter the course of the disease.
So probably, you know, I'm not neither a neuroimager nor a nuclear medicine physician. So for my, let's say, easy thinking, hybrid techniques are different to molecular imaging. Is this true, Nelike? Is molecular imaging something different?
Well, I just wanted to add to what Dr. Spinelli said that I agree that there is a lot of overlap, but also a lot of complementary information, and I think it's that it's a very exciting field to look at both the more advanced MRI techniques and combine it with the PET techniques. I think they can be really overlapping. Like you have, for instance, for neuro-oncology, you have the FET-PET, which is an amino acid tracer, and then with MRI, you have CEST and other advanced MRI techniques that also kind of give you more information on the metabolic features of, for instance, a tumor. But I would like to stress that it doesn't necessarily mean hybrid techniques doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have a PET MRI, because that's obviously something that only very that certain university teaching hospitals have, because you can also perform a PET and do a separate MRI and then combine them and have it in that way hybrid. Because the main advantage, in my opinion, of a PET MRI is the one-stop shop for the patient. So it's more practical, but you can also have hybrid investigations by performing both an MRI and a PET in the same patient in a short time frame. I think though there is overlap, they're also complementary. I think with nuclear medicine, but I'm obviously a little biased, it's a little bit easier to visualize and also quantify certain metabolic processes, but also receptor density and the opportunities are endless. And I also think one very big advantage of nuclear medicine is that it's easier to standardize between the PET scanners and the PET centers also, because I think with MRI that is sometimes can be quite challenging, that the results you get with a very advanced sequences on MRI are not always the same. They can differ even between MRI scanners in the same institution. So I think there is a lot of overlap, but there's also a lot of complementary information. But it's a very exciting field, and I think we will get to know more and more about a lot of neurological diseases by looking at both approaches simultaneously.
So what will be, or what do you think are the emerging fields? Is it neuroinflammation? There are some let's say, preliminary, more research-based investigations on the TSPO, as far as I remember, also with the challenges, because there are some genetic susceptibilities or genetic issues. It is quite, let's say, general rather than specific. So what, apart from a lot of challenges, but what do you think are the emerging fields apart from neuro-oncology, Alzheimer's disease, and also epilepsy?
I think definitely neuroinflammation or visualizing activated microglia is a very, very exciting field. Obviously, the challenges you mentioned make it a little bit more difficult. And also because with the current PET ligands we use for neuroinflammation, it is not, it's not only the activated microglia that you can, that you see, but it's a lot more. But I think neuroinflammation is making a revival, because it was very interesting. There was a lot of interest in the beginning of 2000, neuroinflammation and Alzheimer's disease. And now with the newer ligands, there's renewed interest. But it's also very interesting in epilepsy. It's also very interesting in neuro-oncology, in long COVID. So I think neuroinflammation in general is a very interesting topic to look at. And I think that will be, that will be one of the areas that will provide a lot of new research in the next few years. Of course, the ligands that we have to date for neuroinflammation have limitations. So if there is development of better neuroinflammation ligands, then this field will explode. Besides from the neuroinflammation, which it can be a little bit more experimental, I think that the tau tracers in clinic is going to be the next big thing. So now we have the tau tracers for the amyloid tau, which is, because they are very sensitive but also very specific, they probably have a, can have a large impact in clinic. And I think it would be very exciting to see tau tracers for the other neurodegenerative diseases. I think that's also a very interesting field to follow.
Eduardo, do you have, as a basically clinician, do you have a different view or even expectations regarding emerging fields? Would you like to have more, let's say, information by PET scanning on certain disorders apart, neuro-oncology, dementia, epilepsy?
I agree with Dr. Tolbaum, actually, that tau PET is so far the next frontier, because it is so far being considered mostly a research tool, but it is expected to be the next to be translating into the actual clinical practice. So I agree that this is the most important thing to do as a first step for translation. Regarding other kinds of analysis, we already mentioned the synaptic density tracers. So this is also a very important field that can add us. I mean, my particular expertise is on neurodegenerative diseases, and it has been demonstrated by several animal models or cell cultures that, for example, Alzheimer's disease is a synaptopathy. And so, similar to that, also other kinds of neurodegenerative diseases such as ALS. So I think this is a very exciting field to be developed for all kinds of neurodegenerative diseases. So, for example, SV2A PET in the future. That is my opinion, at least. Yeah.
Excellent. I guess we're definitely but slowly coming to an end. I would like to chat with you for another hour, and hopefully it will be possible that we meet during the EAN Annual Congress in Budapest, and then we will have some coffee or even a beer and detail this much more. I guess the future is bright, so there are an enormous pathway from the understanding, but also from the use technically, including ligands, including tracers, but also techniques in merging the data, because I think that's also something which allowed some advances. And I think both of you are not only declared fans of PET scanning and biased towards this, but also I think alluded very nicely and explained why this is so important also in our daily clinical practice, and that there are some needs, not only to further develop, but also the needs for providing access to this diagnostic procedure. Yes, and with that, I would like to thank also the auditorium and would like to alert you to the next week, which is week 3, on the indications for neuroimaging in acute care. I think also a very important field, and also, let's say, important to have a focused imaging approach in this difficult situation. And with that, thanks both to you, Nelike and Eduardo, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks to you.
Thank you very much. I would just like to briefly add that I'm going to give an update on nuclear neuroimaging in Budapest on the 2nd of July. So if listeners really appreciated this podcast, then they can come to the ANN conference in Budapest and then hear more about it.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.